Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at health and humanitarian crises in the DRC and Sudan. But first, Angola is struggling with a cholera outbreak that is rapidly spreading in the country. The country's health ministry says cholera has killed at least 108 people since the start of the year. There have been 3,147 confirmed cases of the disease since early January, nearly half of them in the capital, Luanda. At least 48 people have died in Luanda and 43 in Bengo, a province neighboring the capital. The victims are children and adults. Cholera is an acute intestinal infection that spreads through contaminated food and water. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a laboratory holding Ebola and other dangerous pathogens in eastern DRC city of Goma is deemed safe, according to the World Health Organization. The laboratory has been seized by the M23 armed group. Thousands have died and huge numbers have had to flee the violence as the force has overtaken swathes of the mineral-rich region. The International Committee of the Red Cross had voiced fears late last month over the risk that fighting in Goma could allow samples of Ebola, Marburg, Mpox, and other pathogens to escape from an important lab in the city. But the WHO said that the situation was under control. The UN on Tuesday warned that the humanitarian situation in eastern Congo had further deteriorated as thousands more are forcibly displaced by fighting between government forces and Rwanda-backed rebels. Civilians caught up in heavy fighting face a critical 24 hours with food and water running low and aid unable to enter. The WHO says the recent rise in violence in eastern DRC is causing substantial loss of life, trauma, displacement, and the destruction of essential health infrastructure. Tensions remain high, and the United Nations and aid groups are expressing concern about the health and safety of the population. Joining us now via phone from Goma is Natalia Torrent, MSF Chief of Program in North Kivu. Médecins Sans Frontières, that is. Natalia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello.
Hello, Natalia. Thank you for joining us today. What is the current situation on the ground in North Kivu, and how are civilians being impacted by fighting, by the fighting in the area?
Well, right now we are in a moment that somehow a calm has regained in town after having seen very strong fightings in the city that has been as well affecting civilians, because unfortunately in this combat civilians has not been a spare. And MSF has been operating in several hospitals, especially since the midst of the intensification around Goma. We have been operating in Dosho, which is a hospital, and we are trying to manage trauma cases. And once the facilities decreased, we were able to enter in another hospital, especially to do trauma management. And we have seen that the figures has been very high, and the civilians has not been a spare of it.
There has been reports of the destruction of health infrastructure in eastern Congo. Talk to us about that and how this is affecting the delivery of medical services to those in need.
Well, in the midst of the fighting, and especially the few days afterwards, we have seen that a lot of, especially warehouse belonging to the eight organizations, among them as well MSF, has been unfortunately looted, making the things much more complex to be able to provide the most needed health support to that population. Right now, obviously, when fighting has been getting closer to populations and getting closer to populated areas, health structures has been affected. And this has decreased the ability to provide that help. For us, the main concern that we have right now, and the main concern, it's around Goma and on the displaced, the internal displaced population camps that has been existing around Goma even before the combats. And this population has been already very close to front lines, meaning that they have been sometimes as well caught in between fire, but as well they have been very much mobile during the days, especially looking for safer spaces. When the combats kind of decreased, some of these people went back to the camps, and actually MSF, we were able to retake the activities that we were already conducting. But in the last days, we have seen a lot of movement of this population out of the camps, not clear where they're heading to, if they're heading to the villages or where they're heading to. And we're very much worried that the places that they may be heading are, it's not safe for them, but as well there are not services to be able to support them.
And what health conditions or diseases are you seeing among the displaced population due to the violence?
Well, as we have seen, as I said before, obviously trauma cases that has been affected. This population has been living in a very dire condition since almost 3 years, some of them. And in the camps, we normally, what we're seeing is a typical kind of like in very much contagious diseases. Now, we have seen in the past cholera, and actually we're monitoring if the cholera cases will be increasing. We have seen as well measles among kids. We're seeing malnutrition, and we're pretty much monitoring, which is a situation because we would be concerned about that. So we are seeing all these type of diseases among this population.
When it comes to medical delivery and treatment, what are some of the challenges? Clearly, the whole situation is challenging, but can you share specific challenges that MSF teams are facing in providing medical assistance?
Well, the days of the fighting and those days for us the most challenging thing was to have secure access to this population to be able to provide the help that they needed. Afterwards, obviously, we're trying to identify and trying to see which would be the next acute needs that this population may have. And as I said, as unfortunately some of our warehouses were looted, so we're trying to understand with just the stocks that we have in the ground to be able to scale up very quickly. Right now, for us, the major uncertainty that we're trying to navigate with is, as I said, this population displacement, and because we're talking about a large number. I mean, around the camps around Goma, there was a moment that they were calculating that there were around 700,000 people. So we are pretty much worried and pretty much trying to understand where these 700,000 people are going to be heading to be able to see if and how we could be able to support them.
And what is MSF's strategy to reach areas where aid is currently blocked? And what kind of support do you need to ensure access?
Well, the way that MSF operates everywhere is that we establish contact and communication with all the parties involved in a conflict, and especially because MSF is pretty much abiding to the humanitarian principles of neutrality and impartiality, and we make very clear that to all the different stakeholders. We are trying to navigate and we're trying to gain this access to this population. So right now, and as we were doing before in Congo, we are establishing conversations and link with all the different actors to be able to gain this humanitarian access to this population.
So as humanitarian aid and agencies work to ensure the safety and health, well-being of the population, what about the safety of the personnel? What kind of challenges have you come across in terms of ensuring that MSF's personnel is also safe?
Indeed, I mean, it has been very challenging, especially the days of the intense fighting in town, because we're trying to continue being operational while ensuring the well-being of our staff. And those days, especially the staff working at the hospitals, they were living a very complex days, especially when fighting was closed by those facilities. We are trying to adapt in our facilities safer space in case safer spaces where our personnel can shelter in case of fighting around. And for us, the way we see this access is obviously that everyone understands very well who is MSF, which are the principles that we use to be able to operate, and as well the acceptance of not only the population of the services that we want to provide, but as well all the actors involved in the conflict. But it's true that in some situations, in some instances, the situations is so complex that we cannot. I mean, the capacity that we have to operate, and especially thinking on the well-being of our personnel, it's pretty much limited.
Mm-hmm. And how is MSF collaborating with other humanitarian actors and local authorities to address this escalating crisis?
Well, right now, I mean, MSF has been is one of the actors present here, and MSF has been present in North Kivu almost for 30 years. So we're pretty much established and pretty much connected and discussing with all the other actors on the ground. I mean, all the other humanitarian, but as well the local authorities, and we're trying to work in collaboration and trying to add up on the results. So we continue that way, coordinating, cooperating, exchanging information, and trying especially to add up for and being able to add up to cover the majority of the needs of this vulnerable population.
What role can regional and international organizations play in addressing the immediate needs of displaced population and improving humanitarian access?
Well, right now I think that the willingness of a lot of organizations is to be able to scale up and to be able to operate. But as the context remain pretty much uncertain on how would we be able to operate, this is kind of not allowing and jeopardizing a little bit the capacity, because the machine, or let's say the system, we're here, the system is ready to operate, but unfortunately so many uncertainties around, it's hindering completely this capacity.
And before we wrap, Natalia, what is your message?
Well, right now, the message that I would like to pass is, especially if this population are leaving the camps, we would like to ask to all the authorities to guarantee a safe return to an area that it's obviously the security is granted, but as well that their access to services for that population.
Okay, Natalia, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Natalia Torrent is MSF Chief of Program in North Kivu, DRC. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. If you're just joining us, we are looking at health and humanitarian crises in Africa. We turn now to Sudan. Sudanese refugees who have made it to Chad speak of burying infants who died of hunger in Darfur's Zamzam displacement camp, and say that people are dying in frequent rapid support forces shelling off the camp. Henry Wilkins spoke with refugees in Adre, Chad.
This man arrived at a refugee site at Chad's border with Sudan 2 days earlier. After making a perilous 340-kilometre journey on foot from the Zamzam displacement camp in North Darfur, the camp is gripped by famine and besieged by the hostile Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The man asked to remain anonymous for security reasons.
I swear, what is happening in Zamzam is devastating. Explosions have turned citizens into corpses. No money and no food. Sometimes you go the whole day eating only one meal.
He recounted how he and other members of the community in Zamzam had to bury 25 infants who had died of starvation. According to the UN, parts of Darfur are in a state of famine, the world's first in 7 years, including the Zamzam camp. Aid groups and residents say the camp of 300,000 inhabitants is also being regularly shelled by the RSF, one of the warring parties in Sudan's civil war that evolved from the Janjaweed militia. Another Zamzam resident who fled to Chad also asked to remain anonymous for fear of reprisals.
When we first arrived, we thought it would be safe because humanitarian organizations were based there. We assumed the Janjaweed wouldn't attack them, but they did.
He said the young and the elderly were the first to perish.
The elderly and children were the most vulnerable. Many families lost their young ones due to malnutrition and lack of medical care.
The UN's World Food Programme says the famine stems from conflict. Lenny Kinsley is head of communications for the World Food Programme in Sudan.
I think the main point is, you know, this is a man-made conflict, and the famine as a result is also man-made. And the solution can only be man-made. A humanitarian pause would be required to ramp up to the scale that's needed to prevent this from really becoming one of the world's worst hunger or famine situations in decades.
As the UN continues to distribute food for the refugees here in Chad, it says the famine in Darfur is expected to spread to 5 more regions of Sudan by mid-2025. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says there have been mass casualties in Sudan over the past few days as both the Sudanese Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces strike populated areas, including the capital Khartoum, North Darfur and South Darfur states. Marcella Cray, MSF coordinator in South Darfur, tells VOA's Caravan Dam that she has seen horrific injuries of civilians in Niala, South Darfur.
What we have seen here in Niala in the last 5 days, we've had 9 separate events of airstrikes. So each airstrike, it means there's a plane coming over, dropping bombs maybe at 6 different occasions. So that's added up to more than 30 bombs being dropped on the city in the last 5 days. What we're seeing in the Omdurman part of Khartoum is more shelling. So it's a little bit of a different thing, but the impact is as devastating. In the North Darfur, it's similar. So it will be drone attacks or shelling as well. So even though the weapons that are used are different, the impact is more or less the same. It's impacting very much on civilians. What we see is many civilians coming into the hospitals that we're supporting.
Where you are in Niala, it says that these were airstrikes by the Sudanese armed forces. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. So I think it's very important to underline that all warring parties in Sudan are using different types of weapons against civilians. It's really, as we are calling it, a war on civilians, a war on people. And it doesn't really matter where you are in the country. And I think that, you know, the last few days have illustrated that very well.
What are you seeing there in Niala? And the MSF doctor that you spoke to about the bombing near the hospital, what did he or she tell you?
Yeah. So what we can see here is the airstrikes happening, and we're sitting through it ourselves with our own teams. So I can tell you it's very intimidating. It's very loud. It's scary. The explosions are very loud. And we've seen them quite close to our hospital, to the point that actually our children's ward had shrapnel, you know, hitting the walls of the ward. And then, of course, what comes after is kind of really, I mean, you know, I don't want to make it too gruesome, but really the carnage that you see afterwards when the patients come in. So we've had a lot of civilians dying, but also for those who do survive, they're really in a bad state often when they come into our emergency rooms. Myself, what I've seen is a woman who had a lot of shrapnel in her arm, and there's a nurse sort of taking it out one by one, you know, and those things are just really horrific to see. And it's people of all ages, it's children, it's older people, everybody being impacted by this. And you know that this is also really impactful for the rest of their lives.
What about North Darfur? There's been fierce clashes there in recent months and weeks. Tell me about that area and the Zamzam camp.
Yes. Now, I have not been in Zamzam camp myself, but of course, we have Doctors Without Borders, MSF colleagues there. And speaking to them, what I understand is really it's very difficult because the facility that they have there is not equipped to deal with these kinds of very extreme cases of trauma. And so they need to refer those patients. However, the roads are closed. So even though you know there's a hospital some kilometers down the road, they're not able to get there. And it means that they actually have patients dying under their hands that, you know, because of the blockage of the roads.
What is MSF trying to, in the interim before there is any kind of ceasefire, what are you trying to see happen so that you can treat patients?
Well, what is very sad to see in Darfur, but even actually in all of Sudan, is that the needs are enormous. And there are not all that many organizations that are willing or able to be active here. And so it means that as MSF, we are doing a lot. We've really scaled up a lot in the last 2 years since the beginning of this war, and supporting with war wounded, but also with feeding programs, for example, because of the war, there's massive malnutrition. A lot of the health structures have collapsed. It means that we're coming in and trying to, you know, pay some kind of money to the health workers, getting the medical supplies in to deal with children's diseases because vaccination is not happening. We're repairing water pumps and all kinds of things. So we're really doing a lot. But if you see how big the needs are and how big the crisis is here, it's still not enough.
That is Marcela Cray, MSF coordinator in South Darfur. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Niala in Sudan, South Darfur in state. We turn now to epilepsy. WHO says around 50 million people worldwide have epilepsy, and nearly 80% of these live in low- and middle-income countries. Epilepsy is a brain condition that causes recurring seizures. Reporter Chimwemwe Padata brings us the story of a patient in Malawi who is battling stigma and misconceptions.
An accountant by profession and employed in the civil service, Hare Singano considers epilepsy like any other disease. Singano, a 55-year-old father of four children, was not born epileptic. He was diagnosed with the disease the past 33 years. At the onset, close relations attributed his condition to superstition.
From my own knowledge, from my own belief, it's not because of my workmates. No, nor my relatives, not at all. Epilepsy started in my body because of perpetual drunkardness.
Singano's epilepsy journey and experience with stigma and discrimination has led him to become a champion of change.
I just want to tell them to strictly follow what they are told to do. If they find any problem, they have to be free. There are certain people, because they say, oh, I don't know epilepsy. I can't talk to somebody. I don't know about epilepsy. It's not supposed to be like that.
Epilepsy can develop sign childbirth when children have suffered trauma during delivery, says Dorothy Ngoma, a seasoned health professional and safe motherhood advocate. She says breaking cycles of misconceptions towards the condition is key.
I have seen this, and over time you follow these babies who were, you know, had delayed deliveries. They tend to get epilepsy. It's although some people may believe to say if you have somebody with epilepsy in the family, maybe it's passed on from family to family. Or sometimes they believe to say if they are having convulsions, don't be near them because you'll be affected if they fart or something like that. You know, the air around them is infectious. Which is wrong. It's not true.
International Bureau for Epilepsy, an advocacy and lobbying organization that fights for the rights of persons with epilepsy, has made inroads around awareness on epilepsy in 16 countries in Africa, including Malawi.
We decided to come up with several interventions. One, we have awareness programs that we support as an organization currently. We are supporting six countries within Africa where they have full-fledged programs around epilepsy. We do community awareness through our chapters, public campaigns with our chapters. We also even train policymakers around epilepsy. We also train caregivers around epilepsy within those programs. And of late, we have also embarked training law enforcers. For example, in Eswatini, as well as in Malawi, we embarked on a special program where we targeted the law enforcers, the police, to be trained. Why? Because there was also limited awareness around the law enforcers.
A 2023 World Health Organization Country Disease Outlook report shows that non-communicable diseases, NCDs, are still a major health problem in Malawi. Malawi Ministry of Health says it has taken measures to respond to the high disease burden of the NCDs.
This is a non-communicable disease, and actually it's manageable. When one is taking medication religiously, people wouldn't even know that this one is epileptic. So we are developing so many messages, including those on epilepsy, to encourage even members of the household to assist anyone with epilepsy within the household, make sure that every day is complying to treatment, and then live a normal life like anybody else.
But even if patients like Singano can control their seizures, stigma and discrimination against those who suffer from the disorder can always be contained. Dispelling misconceptions against this group should therefore be prioritized. Chimwemwe Padata, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
Dr. Chantale Uwase is a general doctor at Precise Healthcare in Nairobi, Kenya. She sheds more light on epilepsy.
Epilepsy is a neurological disorder that presents with seizures. And usually what's happening is that the brain is having abnormal electrical activity, and that is why they seize. Usually it is recurrent. It happens more than one time, and it's unprovoked. We have two broad types, the focal seizures. Those ones originate from a specific part of the brain and also affect a specific part of the body. Then we have the other broad type, the generalized seizures, which also has different types under it. But commonly, I'll just talk about two. The tonic-clonic one, where the jerk and twitch at the same time. And then we have the absence seizures, where we have memory lapse, and sometimes you don't understand what is going on for a brief few seconds. Duration of the seizure depends. Sometimes it will go for 2 minutes, other times it will go for five. Others are prolonged, depending on the cause. And the common causes we see: infections, especially in children, childhood infections. We have brain injuries either due to a fall or stroke or something that will have a trauma to the brain. And then we have other tumors, anatomical changes of the brain that can affect it and cause epilepsy. Drugs, especially in teenagers who are consuming excessive amounts of recreational drugs. Genetic predisposition. Sometimes it's just something that runs in the family and there is no other cause. And then most often than not, actually, the cause is not even known. It just happens. There's no genetic predisposition. There is no known cause. There is no infection, but it is there. Stigma and that fear, and maybe relating it to witchcraft, or it's a taboo, you're not supposed to have a child like that, or it's like a punishment from God. So that inhibits management or proper treatment for these patients. And then our medical health services are also limited. So even if it's early, there's early presentation, sometimes parents don't take the children. Again, it comes down to traditional beliefs. Some believe that it's not a white man's disease to treat. It's traditionally managed, which normally interferes. So in epileptics, we advise for, first of all, adherence to your medication. Take your medication as prescribed, the frequency, the timing, and also visits to the doctor. So if you're not taking your medication, non-compliance is one major cause, one main cause, because they go through phases of denial, acceptance, all that after diagnosis.
That's Dr. Chantale Uwase, General Doctor at Precise Healthcare in Nairobi, Kenya. And that's all for this edition of Health Chat. I'm your host, Lina Khmudu in Washington, with producer Mukbilia Barrow. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.